I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, books on maps. People have always been fascinated with maps. They give us a whole new perspective, whether they're maps of actual places or imaginary worlds. Joining us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And somebody knows a thing or two about maps. Chris Poloni, retired information technology specialist from the U.S. Geological Survey Seafloor Mapping Group. Welcome.
Good morning, Mindy and Jill.
Nice to have you here. All right, Jill, maps, you think... How many books could there be on maps?
And right, that's right. That's what I
thought. We could probably sit here all morning and talk about these books.
We could, well, and it's much like last month when we were doing fairy tales, where we could have just done Cinderella. And this is the same idea, which is that once you start diving into the world of maps, you see that it is everywhere. And while my particular interest is fictional maps, because I love a book with a great map in it, I am so glad Chris is here this morning to help us with the real mapping in the world. And I was noticing, as happens whenever we're going to do a show, all the mentions of maps in the world. Most recently, yesterday, there was a big article in the New York Times about gerrymandering of maps, which, as it turns out, all goes back to Elbridge Gerry, who was governor of Massachusetts in 1812, signed into law a state legislative map that included an irregularly shaped district obviously drawn to benefit his party. A cartoon in the Boston Gazette archly observed that the map resembled a salamander and added a head, wings, and claws to bring it to life. So even in yesterday's newspaper, we're reading about maps. I am fascinated by them, but the last map that I actually created would have been a map in eighth grade when I had to make a map out of salt dough. Have you ever seen a salt dough map where you use flour and water of the entire country, the continent of Africa?
Oh, boy.
And now, of course, if I, in fact, still had this map, which I do not, although I loved it dearly when I made it, it would be of little use because, of course, countries change names all the time in the world in which we live. So it's a very interesting topic to me. There are great poems I've discovered that were written about maps. You can draw maps of like family relations, which can be really helpful if you're having trouble with your family and how people are connected. I personally am terrible at reading maps. It is one of the reasons I'm really happy GPS came along.
Give me that atlas. I have the GPS too.
But to dream, if you want to dream about maps, you need the real atlas.
That's for
and
sure.
I think the dreaming of maps and how maps influence our psyche and how our imaginations are of real interest to me. Yeah. And I'm sort of going to be more of the imaginary map gal today, but we have our real mapper us.
You are so excited about this program on maps today, Jill, and I would think it would be Chris would be the one jumping out of his seat, the map guy over here.
Maps are imaginary, actually. I mean, they're all somebody's imagination. I mean, I actually brought along Oceanus, which isn't actually a published book, but it's a published magazine. And you see the map on the front was done by Heason and Tharp. Turns out this is all their imagination. It's still in use. National Geographic still has the Heason and Tharp publication. But if you look at the real Smith, there's a couple of guys out in the West Coast that have the latest data. It was derived from satellite information, gravity, and so forth. And it's an image of the seafloor, which is in reality a digital map. The Heason and Tharp was the last one done by hand. And it's all how they thought it. And I remember Bob Ballard giving a talk here at HUI and saying it was their imagination because the Mid-Atlantic Ridge doesn't go there in certain places around the globe. But it's pretty good, and it's a nice general representation, which is actually what all maps are. They're a representation of what you think it looks like.
All right, let's get into the books. Jill, what's your first book?
All right. Well, I'm going to actually start with the poem because the poem...
You want to get that poem in there.
Because I've got to get the poem in, and it's going to take just a minute to read it. But also because I really will be interested to hear what Chris has to say if he's never heard this poem before. And it's in part about what maps look like, what the actual map looks like, and how what one sees depends on how one looks. And in this poem by Elizabeth Bishop, she's looking at a real map, which will become really clear, I think, as I read this. But listen carefully, Chris, and all of you listeners out there. It's called The Map. Land lies in water. It is shadowed green. Shadows, or are they shallows? at its edges, showing the line of long sea-weeded ledges where weeds hang to the simple blue from green? Or does the land lean down to lift the sea from under, drawing it unperturbed around itself? Along the fine, tan, sandy shelf is the land tugging at the sea from under. The shadow of Newfoundland lies flat and still. Labrador is yellow, where the moony Eskimo has oiled it. We can stroke these lovely bays under a glass as if they were expected to blossom, or as if to provide a clean cage for invisible fish. The names of seashore towns run out to sea. The names of cities cross the neighboring mountains. The printer here experiencing the same excitement as when emotion too far exceeds its cause. These peninsulas take the water between thumb and finger like women feeling for the smoothness of yard goods. Mapped waters are more quiet than the land is, lending the land their wave's own confirmation. And Norway's hair runs south in agitation. Profiles investigate the sea where land is. Are they assigned, or can the countries pick their colors? What suits the character or the native waters best? Topography displays no favorites. North's as near as west. More delicate than the historians are the map makers' colors. It's this real tribute to map makers, but it's also looking at a real map, but thinking about, again, sort of how it looks depending on what you see. And when she's talking about the hair of Norway, she's in the H-A-R-E, the shape of the country.
The fjords.
And the colors. Yeah. And just this idea of, like, who picks the colors on the maps? Do you know the answer to that?
Oh, I don't necessarily know the answer, but it was something we talked about earlier about geologists like to have certain colors in their maps. And they are very particular about that. But the other word that didn't come out of that poem, you mentioned topography, and she was talking about underwater topography, and the word bathymetry comes up to me. And I think you mentioned that you hadn't heard of bathymetry, but that is the underwater topography. But I love that. You could almost imagine the seaweed and the coastal dynamics of what's going on the beach. And I was thinking of fjords in Norway and
incisions
and so forth.
And and the physical letters that you'll find on the map sort of falling off into the sea, which is also
she really
a lovely
did capture
image.
It, didn't she?
And I love mentioning Newfoundland because Nova Scotia and Newfoundland are dear to my heart, actually. And I'm going to talk about that in a little bit.
All right. Which first book?
My first book is, in fact, about how maps can work, help the imagination, and can help writers. And this is a fascinating book. And I have to say, I really thought this was an incredibly interesting book. Alas, nobody in Clams, our network, has a copy. But I'll make sure that that changes. The book is called Maps of the Imagination, The Writer as Cartographer by Peter Turchi. And it's essentially talking about the metaphor of a map, which is what she was doing as well. And the opening chapter begins with a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson, which says, "The writer is an explorer. Every step is an advance into new land." And he talks about how maps work with writers. The earliest extant alphabetic texts, the earliest extant geographical maps, and the earliest extant map of the human brain date back to the same general period around 3000 BC. While no one can say for certain when the first writing and mapping occurred, the reasons for recording who we are, where we are, what is, and what might be haven't changed much over time. And he goes on to say, ask for a map is to say, tell me a story, and how maps can tell us various stories and how the writer can basically be the explorer. And one of the great things about this book, it is just filled with beautiful illustrations of various kinds of maps. And it was also just written up in an article in the New Yorker. Again, once you start noticing maps, they're everywhere. Just this month, they wrote an article about maps. And in this, he talks about this book and says that all writers are map makers. writers and that all writing is like a map. For Turchi, the map is more than metaphor. It is an organizing principle of narrative. Language is like a land. Paragraphs are districts. Sentences are streets. And words are only lines and curves constructed the way maps are made of lines and shapes. Letters are like wild canyons and chaotic seas that the writer maps into words and then into sentences and then into scenes. So a really different way about learning about maps and thinking about maps. And one of the reasons I love this book is that clearly the guy that wrote it loves maps and, as it happens, is also a writer. So therefore, he is connecting these two things that he dearly loves and putting them together in this sort of essay after essay on how these things connect, and goes back to things like Robert Louis Stevenson and Treasure Island and various novels that contain maps in them or begin with maps.
You need those when you have an imaginary place. If you don't have the map, it's really sometimes hard to picture. You need those.
That's right. And Stevenson's novel apparently, in fact, began with a map that he drew and started by drawing the map and then moved on to actually writing about the map and the place.
Right, Chris, what's your first book?
Well, I like that. Maybe spinning off on that, I'm going to actually pick one of my other books before my first book.
It's okay.
Maps and Memes. It was written by a Canadian grad student. Actually, he got his PhD, and this actually follows on one of his publications. And it's about redrawing culture, place, and identity in Indigenous communities. And Maps and Memes, it's place names. This really drew my attention. The place names that index specific landmarks are told in sequence to form stories or verbal maps describing times of travel for people to follow. These, however, were guidelines earlier than actual trails on the ground. For the latter, responsive to variations in the distribution of natural resources and other contingencies would wind back and forth along the guidelines in the verbal map. So it really, he gets into describing why place names that actually tell a story about the early tribes, the indigenous peoples of the Americas, which I found very, I didn't get a chance to read this whole book, but it has some really interesting segments. There again, this is not in the library. I found this in my search for new books. This is 2015.
This is a new book.
This is just out in November 2015, so it's a fairly
new
book.
And I should make it clear that if you know, somebody in our library doesn't have it, we often can get it from a library off Cape.
I'm sure you could. This is sort of an academic essay in a way. His name is Guillem Lucas Iedes. So it's a long name.
Easier to remember the name of the book, Maps and Memes. All right, Jill, what have you got?
Well, here's another really just a fun map book called Plotted, a Literary Atlas. And what these guys decided to do was to take various maps, various novels, and actually they do have one nonfiction, it's not all novels, and create maps for them. But they gave themselves this idea that they needed rules. And so one of the rules was they didn't want to do books that had already been mapped, thus leaving out things like The Hobbit, The Chronicle of Narnia, things that, you know, already come with maps, Treasure Island. And they apparently actually drew 50 maps, which turned out to be a little too much for their publisher. So now it's down to 19 maps. But they've done some very interesting things. So one of the things that they did was Moby Dick. Now, Moby Dick, you'd think, oh, they might do a map of the seas. They might do a map of Nantucket. But what they did, and here's how they explain it. There's a little essay with each one of these maps. What they say about Nantucket is, as a result, in trying to map this great work, we've set aside Nantucket and the sprawling seas and focused instead on the two main combatants, the whaling ship and the whale. So, in fact, what they have is a map of the Pequod here and all the parts of the Pequod, and a map of
the whale.
Moby Dick himself and all the parts of the whale. So they've approached each one a little bit differently. They've done a map of Around the World in 80 Days, and one of the reasons they chose that was, as they write, few works of fiction are as geographically oriented as Around the World in 80 Days. What's interesting about the book, however, isn't the actual geography involved. Indeed, the cities and countries involved in Phileas Fogg's travels are still quite recognizable to us now, almost 150 years later, but rather the way that Verne forced Victorian readers to reimagine what this geography meant. He took a world that still seemed enormous, with plains that stretched for days and seas that that took months to cross, and made a convincing case that humans already had the technology to make the world a much smaller place. Mm. So a much bigger theme than you might think. And then one that's just sort of fun is the one they do of Pride and Prejudice, where they have sort of the romantic courses of the characters of Pride and Prejudice in sort of an intertwined sort of roller coaster. Right. Mm. And it's a pieces of cities and a roller coaster kind of thing. So very different from all the others.
Very imaginative.
Fun. And again, a way you can sort of get into literature through a map, which who knew until I started looking at maps.
We are talking about Books on Maps. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to add something to our list. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about Books on Maps. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us today, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Chris Poloni, retired information technology specialist from the U.S. Geological Survey Seafloor Mapping Group. What have you got in your hands right there now, Chris?
Okay, when Jill and I first, she invited me to be on the program, the first book that we actually agreed on was Longitude by Dava Sobel. And somebody actually gave this to me when it was published in 1995. It was for Chris, the mapper, would love Pam. Anyway, that was so cute. And I read the book throughout, and it's a book with no illustrations. I mean, it was all about John Harrison, this guy that made the first chronometer. And it says here, anyone alive in the 18th century would have known that longitude problem was the thorniest scientific dilemma of the day, and had been for centuries. Lacking the ability to measure their longitude, sailors throughout the great ages of exploration had been literally lost at sea as soon as they lost sight of land. Thousands of lives and increasing fortunes of nations hung in the resolution. The quest for a solution had occupied scientists and their patrons for the better part of the two centuries, when in 1714 England's Parliament upped the ante by offering a king's ransom, £20,000, or approximately $12 million in today's currency, to anyone whose method or device proves successful. And there are all kinds of people. Mostly what the book is about is astronomers, because the mathematicians of the day knew they could measure the movement of the moon and the stars, and they could figure it out by using celestial observation. Well, along came this mechanic. He was a self-taught engineer that built clocks. But to take a clock to sea, it had to be special. It had to be immune to moisture. It had to be immune to motion. There were a lot of factors and temperature. You know, there are a lot of factors that would affect a mechanism that went to sea, and they always lost time. John Harrison built H1, which proved to be a very precise clock. And then he built H2. And these things you didn't build overnight. Mm. It took him years to build these things because they were very precise devices that went into these clocks. And he has a clock actually in this book. Well, when I mentioned the book, I went to the library, the illustrated book, the illustrated longitude. And I'm going, what is that? You know, I was this book. Well, it turns out this fellow, William Andrews, worked at Harvard. He was in the library, in the map library. And he met Dava Sobel, and he decided he wanted to have a conference in Boston. And it was about 1993, and he invited Dava to come, and she, for the conference, he wrote up the conference proceedings, and she wrote about longitude, about John Harrison, a very intimate book about John Harrison, all the stuff he had to go through, finally, to actually be successful. His son actually took his clocks to the final. It's a really interesting read. But anyways, that text is in this book. It's the same text, but guess what? It has all these illustrations.
Oh, wow.
And they're beautiful illustrations. And it shows the original clock, H1, was like 4 feet by 4 feet. H4 and H5 were about a little big. They were about, that's the actual size. So they're about 5 inches across. But this is what was designed to go to sea with a ship's captain. And actually they had to sail from England across to the Caribbean to prove that this timepiece could
work,
maintain.
Yeah. It's so great to have, but what a difference the illustrations make, huh?
So what happened was Dava got a lot of complaints. There were no pictures in her book. So she got to back together with Wilhelm. And in 1999, they published The Illustrated, which is a fan. There again, the text still, I read over the text last night just reviewing it. And the pictures just enhance it so much.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Well, it was a good idea. All right, let's talk to Harriet, who's giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Harriet.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, great. I just wanted to say it's a wonderful, wonderful topic, and thank you for doing the show, and thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk a little bit about personal experiences around the connection between maps and creativity and imagination and memory. And I wanted to give a shout out to a woman who's taught for many years at Wellesley College Art Department, Bunny Harvey, who in her first painting classes with young students often would ask people to start with painting a map of their memories, of their homes, their childhood, even that particular day, and using it as a trigger for translating emotion and memory into visual terms. And I thought that was a beautiful thing. And the other thing that was very profound for me was working with my mother, collecting her stories. She came from Lithuania, and she was a great storyteller. And in trying to work with lots of things to try to ignite her storytelling ability, and one was to make a 3D map of this little shtetl that she grew up in by making little clay houses and suggestive stuff, and then having her remember and arrange the town the way she remembered it, and each little, many of the little houses or the animals or the geographical features that we made out of handmade, available stuff, would trigger a story.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a wonderful thing to do with somebody, with an older person who came from a different world, whether it was that far away or whether it was just back in time, to help people to recreate memories.
Yeah, and like you say, triggering those memories. That's a great, Harry, thanks for the call. That's a great idea.
Well, thanks for the show.
Oh, you're welcome. Interesting. Let's talk to Fritz, who's calling from Kootenai. Hi, Fritz.
Hello. I have a book to recommend and something about maps and books in general.
Okay.
The book is The Map Thief, which is about a local bad guy in Martha's Vineyard who made a fortune on stealing maps from books.
We remember that.
Yeah, and that's a great read, actually.
Edward Smiley.
It is. And my second point is that I read a lot of nonfiction that includes locations and geographies that are very difficult to look up. For instance, if you go to Google Maps, you cannot find where one stream connects with a river or a reef is and out at sea. Or there are so many things that would be interesting to be able to find on Google Earth if you could find geographical locations that had nothing to do with shopping malls or highways or business locations.
Yeah, good point.
Go to the seafloor mapping group's maps.
Yeah, there you go.
And see where these points of references are.
Yeah. Fritz, thanks.
I think we have place names in the ocean that you can find. And there's a whole geographic names procedure that USGS has. Recently, they just named some features on Stellwagen Bank, for example. Paige Valentine from our office here in Woods Hole did a lot of mapping on Stellwagen. And there are place names there. And some of them are named after people that we know.
Wow, interesting. So. Yeah. Fritz, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. You actually have a book that has mentions that Martha's Vineyard map.
We do. The book On the Map, written by, actually has an introduction by Dava Sobel. This is a recent book, and Dava is still hot with it. It's On the Map, and this is by... Yeah, who's the author?
Simon Garfield.
It's a really neat book, and it talks. It has a lot of different chapters, and it's about the biggest map dealer, the biggest map thief.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
They caught him right here in over in Yale. But the next chapter I thought was interesting, and it relates to what Bonnie was talking about. Women can't read maps. Oh, really?
Oh, and, really? That's right. Oh, really? That's right. Although Jill says she can't. I can.
So a lot of maps just aren't designed necessarily for women. There is a difference in perception a lot of different people. According
See,
to this chapter.
I knew there was a reason I couldn't read maps.
So in this book, I mean, you can read about it. But this is a fairly new book, too. I think it was. Yeah.
So you've got to tell us the difference now. What's the difference in perception? I mean, what women like?
It's spatial. I think women like the big picture. They don't necessarily like GPSs that have this little localized image, although guys like them. I mean, you can go out on your boat now and your iPhone. You can see the bathymetry underneath Woods Hole. Yeah. I mean, it's really handy.
Yeah. All right. Jill?
Well, I've got here a book that sort of talks in part about Google Maps and how that is transforming the world. And it's called, the book, A History of the World in 12 Maps by Jerry Broughton. And he takes 12 different maps, starting with Ptolemy's geography in AD 150, and moves up through information section on Google Earth 2012. And here's what he says about what he's doing. It says, the book takes 12 world maps from cultures and moments in world history and examines the creative processes through which they tried to resolve the problems faced by their makers, from perception and abstraction to scale, perspective, orientation, and projection. The problems are constant, but the responses are specific to the map maker's particular culture, and we discovered that what drove them was as much personal, emotional, religious, political, and financial as geographical, technical, and mathematical, that each map either shaped people's attitudes to the worlds in which they lived or crystallized a particular worldview at specific moments in global history, often both. And so these are all maps that were created at particular moments. And he does talk a little bit here about Google, as I said. And what he says is that Google Earth, and Chris, you may or may not agree, I'm sure you have opinions on Google Earth, has not just set the standard for these applications, but has led to a complete reevaluation of the status of maps and the future of map making, allowing maps to appear more democratic and participatory than ever before. It seems that anywhere on the earth can potentially now be seen and mapped by anyone online without the inevitable subjective bias and prejudice of the cartographer. And as the cartographic limits of what it is possible to create online are expanded, so are the definitions of a map and its maker. So that they're not just doing this little project, but this project is changing map making in very profound ways. And this book, again, is called A History of the World in 12 Maps by Jerry Broughton. Do you think Google is doing these things?
Changing
map making?
It certainly has. I mean, online mapping has been a thorn in the side of the USGS in a way, because we had a very classic way of putting together quad sheets, and they were very specific. In fact, even today, when the USGS people want to put together a map, they still have to go to their cartographers to finish it, even though we can generate very automatic maps. And the final products tend to be published as a featured map with all the artistic base layers that are required for our template. You know, there's a USGS template that has to be adhered to. But in general, what people really want is a layer, and that gets into GIS systems, because GIS software tends to generate all the maps nowadays. Google is sort of a GIS, but basically GIS systems are based on databases. The town of Falmouth, for example, has an ArcInfo system, and they have all the layers of the town, including the taxes, all the features of anything that's spatially referenced in the town. And you can find out who owns what and what their taxes are, how many people are living there, all that good information. But basically, automatic maps are the thing of today, but they're not necessarily published. These are maps you work with. So what you come up, bring up in Google, in fact, a lot of the layers that USGS publishes are available as Google layers, so you can superimpose the bathymetry off the coast of the Cape Cod or anywhere with land layers, landforms that are referenced and show the topography. So can I talk about a little?
Yes,
mapping journey I thought was kind of neat, and it goes back to Ptolemy. And a lot of your books, Alexander the Great started the city of Alexandria in Egypt. And Ptolemy was one of his first experts. You know, he was a mathematician, a geographer, an astronomer, and I know Jill loves this. He's an astrologer and a poet. I mean, he was everything.
A well-rounded
yeah, for sure.
And
fellow.
Of course, everybody refers to him as one of the first map makers. And there's a map in this book, Mapping the World. I'm pulling up the three kids books that I picked. We all have adult books, but I thought I'd grab three kids books. And the first one is Sylvia Johnson, Mapping the World. And of course, the first cartographer is mentioned in there. That's a nice first chapter. And these are good for kids in the grade school. They're available at the library. I went and got them, and I love it. And this encyclopedia maps hands-on approach geography. And a lot of them start with how do you look around you? What does your school look like? What does the library look? I looked at the floor plan of the library, you know. And we had a friend come over and visit us. Sonny came by, and first thing he did was start sketching on a map of my room. And he walked around the house, and he did the house. And then he walked around the house and he did the backyard. You know, he really had a spatial concept of what was around him. And all these books actually start with that. And that's what our call-in person, Bonnie, said. You know, that's how you start. And that's how you started, Jill, with your little clay map.
That's right.
And then we got to Map Mania. And, of course, our friend, Mike DeSpizio, who was on earlier this week with Heather.
Who we love Public Library.
I love Mike. He and I actually have collaborated on 3D displays and so forth. He does what I call anaglyph, and I'll mention that, I think, before we close out. But Mike has Discover Where You Are and Getting to Where You Aren't. And, of course, Mike is the original critical thinker. He wrote the book about critical thinking. But in his book.
But also a very fun guy.
He is amazing. Yeah, so sure. He's got this amazing book. It actually mentions this was published in 2000, a little past 2000. But he also mentions GPS, you know. But that only a few years ago, it was just a handheld device. You know, you didn't really have a lot of hands-on stuff. But in this book, I'm fingering through it, and this thing caught my eye: The Lost Treasure of Oak Island. And I said, I've heard of this. And one of our lab people, Judy Comeau, came into work one day with this map, and it's a map of Canada. It's Nova Scotia, and it's a mystery map. And I mentioned it the other day. I was at the Art Center at a meeting, and I met Joan Vaughn. And it turns out the Vaughn family is intimately involved in this treasure map. And it evolves from Massachusetts to Rhode Island to Nova Scotia.
Wow.
And this lost, it's almost like the Bermuda Triangle. They've been digging holes up there. They finally stopped them from digging holes. But anyways, I got to talk to Mike and find out why he mentions
it. Why?
In his book.
I thought it was going to be something. Yeah,
it's a booby trap thing. Yeah. Well, it's about concepts.
Concepts, yeah.
And drawing maps.
Yeah, fun.
Well, I also brought a couple of children's books, one of which is called Mapping Penny's World. Mm. And in this case, Penny is the young girl's dog. And again, it's just as you were saying, Chris, it starts out in the classroom, sort of this is how you can think about mapping. It's definitely for young children. And the classroom is mapping the world as you begin. And they're talking about all the concepts and like what to include on your maps, the title, the key, the symbols, the scale, you know, everything you might include. And then she decides she's going to map the world of her dog. And I love the description she gives of the maps that supposedly go between Penny, the dog's friend, Maxine, and the house in which the girl lives. So this is how she said you could explain this in a map. Go out your back door, turn right by the trash cans, crawl under the gap in the wooden fence, watch out for the big orange cat, squeeze through the bushes, turn left, look for the yellow fire hydrant, turn right on the sidewalk, go to the third house on the right with a red door, sit down in front of it and bark. Woo! Or you could draw a map instead. So this is how, and then they show the Maxine's route, the dog's friends to her house and how she drew it and the symbolism for the bush, the symbol for the wood fence, for the fire hydrant, for the cat. It's a very sweet intro to mapping for children. And the other enormous book I brought is called Just Maps, which just recently came out, illustrated by Alexandra Misilenska and Daniel Misilenska. I'm sorry for the pronunciation. And what this is just a beautiful book of maps, huge maps of continents, of countries. It is very quirky. What it has is a million things to look at on every spread. So it is going beyond the map walls to tell us about the flag of the country, some of the big places that you might visit, the animals, the food, all of this. So, for example, for Iceland, you'll look at the plants, and it has willow, heather, rowanberries, crowberries, juniper, blueberries, cranberries, lots of various plants that you might find in the country. My one complaint about this is that in the U.S. map, for example, the only two women, she also has sort of famous people from each country, the only two women that are illustrated are Marilyn Monroe and a cheerleader, which really doesn't seem right. to me like the best representation necessarily of U.S. women. Yeah. All the countries aren't in here. But in terms of a small child just falling in love with maps, this book would do it because the illustrations are so beautiful, so whimsical, and you do get a lot of information out of them as well.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about books on maps with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Chris Poloni, retired information technology specialist from the U.S. Geological Survey Seafloor Mapping Group. If you have a book you'd like to recommend for our list, which we will put a link to all of the books up on the website a little later this afternoon, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have an email from Deirdre in Monument Beach, and she says, you should mention to your listeners that the exhibit featuring John Harrison's clocks, some are the originals, some are working reproductions, are on exhibit right now at Mystic Seaport. It's a temporary exhibit, so time is of the essence. And she sent us a link to Mystic's website, which we will put up on our website. That's great. Great, Deirdre. Thanks for that information.
And there's actually also a big map exhibit right now at the Boston Public Library as well, which I think, though, that's going up through March at least. Mm-hmm. So, and let's not forget, I'm sure, have you been in the Maparium in Boston? You've never been in the Maparium.
Oh,
Chris, I have to take you on a field trip. Which is, for those of you that don't know, it is this tremendous glass globe, essentially, that you can walk into the middle of, which is at the Christian Science Center in Boston. Spectacularly beautiful. The sound when you're in this map, which is all glass, is just terrific. And you can hear, you can be at one side of the room, which is the inside of the map, and whisper, and somebody can hear you all the way. And have you been
haven't. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. It is so beautiful. But it also is one of those lessons about maps, which is when you look at the countries, because this was done in 1930 something, I can't remember. But in any case, the countries have changed, you know,
of course,
and that's the political nature
of
maps.
Have you ever seen the Delorme map? You heard of Delorme?
I have, but I don't. I've never seen.
If you go to Maine and you get off Route 1 on your way to L.L. Bean,
they do lots of atlases, right?
There's a big building there, and you can see this rotating globe inside that they've constructed. It's
so there's another road trip.
It's just up the street from crab meat. You can get shots every day. Crab meat.
What have you got next, Jill?
I have brought another really fun book. This one is called Maphead by Ken Jennings. And you may know Ken Jennings because he won Jeopardy.
I was going to say, was that Ken Jennings?
This is the same Ken Jennings, best known as the record holder for the longest Jeopardy winning streak in history. But he's also a really fun writer, and he, not surprisingly, loves maps. And he claims that he used to go to sleep every night as a kid with a bulky Hammond World Atlas by his pillow every night. So that's when he began his Jeopardy career. But what this book does is talks about all, he does love maps, and he goes every possible direction from maps, from neuroscience to pop culture to gender identity to religion. He interlaces all of this trivia with stories about his own life and his genuine love of maps. But what caught my eye, and you will not be surprised to hear this, Mindy, is that much to my amazement, one of his chapters begins with the novel Islandia, which is one of my favorite novels that I have spoken of previously on this
a
show.
A few times.
A novel by Austin Tappan Wright. But what I never knew before was that Austin and thanks to this book called Maphead, Wright actually grew up in Cambridge, which I had no idea, where his father, a prominent Greek scholar, was the dean of Harvard's graduate school. He studied at Harvard and Oxford, practiced law in Boston, and then turned to teaching at Berkeley and Penn. But only his family knew that for most of his 48 years, he had also lived somewhere else entirely, the remote Southern Hemisphere nation of Islandia. And it goes on to describe, which is a wonderful novel, but also one of the great things about that novel is that map on the end papers. And I think once you've seen the map on the end papers, you either fall for the country, you know, or you don't. But he also talks about how he invented this whole world and he mapped it out himself. But he also would be riding around with the family and say something like, oh, that view looks like Islandia. You know, for him, it was such a real place. Mm. And this chapter goes on to great length about describe what Islandia was like. And I just love that this book has a whole,
you're right. I'm not surprised.
On Islandia. Ken Jennings, thank you very much.
Well written.
What have you got, Chris?
I have to mention this one book. This is another book that's not in the library, but I have a special attachment to it.
I'm writing, Chris.
It's called Infinite Perspectives, 2,000 Years of Three-Dimensional Mapping. So it talks about perspective, and in fact, the vertical perspective. And it's written by Brian M. Ambrosiak and Jeffrey Ambrosiak. These two guys, one's an academic. He actually has written algorithms for spatial recognition. But my intimate relationship with this one is they dedicate this book to their father, Russ Ambrosiak, who did a lot of the algorithms that are in this book on infinite perspectives. And in fact, you open this up and it starts off with a 3D perspective of Mount St. Helens, which is one of the geologic features that are in 3D. And there are 3D glasses included in this. This book sold for over $100 when it came out. You can get it on Amazon, obviously, for a pretty good price. I got to think I ordered it for $12.
Wow.
And look at this. It's a beautiful book.
Well, 12, the library can afford that.
But what's really, Russ was amazing. We would bring data to him on 9-track tape or cassette or whatever. We'd bring him data, and he would say, if I can't display this on the screen before lunch, I'll buy you lunch.
Wow. How sweet.
I never got lunch from Russ. I always bought him lunch. Mm-hmm. And recently, we published a lot of data at USGS in 3D. And actually, I have a picture of Al Vine looking at a 3D perspective of the East Coast of the United States, bathymetry, with 3D glasses on. And recently, Russ was asked if he could redo a data set that we did for Mike Bothner. Mike was studying where the outfall site was in Boston Harbor, and the raw data was never really displayed. We made a map, but the raw data was never displayed. And Russ got a call from Mike, and Mike sent this PDF up, and sure enough, it's a 3D display. And I've got to actually put the outfall site on here because it wasn't there. This is pre-outfall site.
Wow.
It was USGS was asked to map that area. Mm. Of course, we've gone on. Brad Buttman has published some extensive maps of the Mass Bay area, and we have new maps, exciting new maps of sand ripples in the bays and Buzzes Bay and Martha's Vineyard and so forth. But I recommend this book as a nice history of vertical 3D mapping, and it's complete with anaglyph, what I call anaglyphs. Mike Despizio, I think, would like to see this because of
yeah, it's a bit. It's like a coffee table book. It's a big book.
It is.
Yeah, it's a pretty
this
book.
This is an atlas.
Yeah.
It's
good for weightlifting as
well. Exactly.
Yeah. Joanne is giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. This is not a book about maps. It's just that, well, I was a children's librarian, and I thought that maybe one of the first ideas about maps might have come to a child from reading Winnie the Pooh, because mm-hmm. the end papers are all about the 100-acre wood and mm-hmm. all the places that Winnie's friends lived and worked. Not worked.
I know.
Play.
Yeah, their little thing.
Yeah.
Climb trees.
Yeah. I didn't
look
hear
for
the
honey.
Beginning of your program, but I assume that maybe we didn't get into the idea of children first seeing maps and getting the idea of a map.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion.
And there's a recent book, and I can't remember the title of it, about Winnie the Pooh, and it's talking about the actual places that were mapped in that map. So it's a very interesting thing. And I was trying to remember what would have been the first map I sort of saw, and that certainly would have been one of them, and how I got so excited and interested in mapping and the idea of places. But Winnie the Pooh is a great map. The Hobbit has a great map. There are a lot of kids' books that have beautiful maps in them, and I'm really happy you mentioned Winnie the Pooh's map.
Hey, Joanne, thanks for the phone call. Jill, what have you got?
Well, moving on with imaginary places, seeing as we just talked about Winnie the Pooh, I have in my hands the newly updated and expanded classic, The Dictionary of Imaginary Places by Alberto Manguel, who also wrote The History of Reading, and Gianni Guadalupe. And I have to mention, there is a beautiful map in here of fairyland, if you've been wondering what fairyland. And it gets back to that thing that maps make things more real for us, you know, that once we see them. But it also has this section, this map of some place called Arkham, which I had never, ever heard of. And it turns out that Arkham, an old city in Massachusetts in the United States, now mind you, this is fictional, crossed by the murky Miskatonic River. Arkham was founded in the first years of the 17th century and goes on to talk about everything. It turns out it's a place in H.P. Lovecraft's story, The Outsider and Others. And who knew that there was, but they have a very detailed map in here of all the streets. They, of course, have 6 pages on Islandia because there's so much to know about Islandia as well as the map. And they have the beautiful Wizard of Oz map, the Marvelous Land of Oz, which is another place a lot of children probably see one of their earliest maps is through those Oz maps. So everything in here. And they also have, which is, again, another one of my favorite books, The Phantom Tollbooth. They have a map of the Wisdom Kingdom, which is reached via a tollbooth. Travelers wishing to visit the kingdom are given a kit containing maps, coins, and a book of rules. Results are not guaranteed, but waste of time will be refunded. And so that's all from Norton Jester's The Phantom Tollbooth. And the book I'm looking at is The Dictionary of Imaginary Places. And you could spend literally hours not just reading the entries in here and looking at all the beautiful maps they've had drawn specifically for the book, but going back to read a lot of books you might have missed.
Right. I want to check out that Wizard of Oz map. Now, we've got one more?
I've got one more poem.
Okay.
And this is a poem by Wisława Szymborska, and she wrote a poem called Map. Flat as the table it's placed on, nothing moves beneath it, and it seeks no outlet. Above, my human breath creates no stirring air and leaves its total surface undisturbed. Its plains, valleys are always green, uplands, mountains are yellow and brown, while seas, oceans remain a kindly blue beside the tattered shores. Everything here is small, near, accessible. I can press volcanoes with my fingertip, stroke the poles without thick mittens. I can with a single glance encompass every desert with the river lying just beside it. A few trees stand for ancient forests. You couldn't lose your way among them. In the east and west, above and below the equator, quiet like pins dropping, and in every black pinprick, people keep on living. Mass graves and sudden ruins are out of the picture. Nations' borders are barely visible as if they wavered to be or not. I like maps because they lie, because they give no access to the vicious truth, because great-heartedly, good-naturedly, they spread before me a world not of this world.
All right, who would have thought we'd start and end with a poem?
You never know.
Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Chris Poloni, retired information technology specialist from the U.S. Geological Survey Seafloor Mapping Group. Thanks so much. Chris, thanks so much for joining us. It was a lot of fun having you.
Thanks for the invitation.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point with production assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.